On Revision today, the story of the reluctant president.
Horrifying images of emerging of a chemical weapons attack in Syria, with hundreds of men, women and children killed.
The images from a social media website are unverified and highly disturbing. People with tissues to their eyes, children crying, a man convulsing on the ground appearing to gasp for breath. Syria's opposition claims chemical weapons were used and 1,300 people were killed.
Images emerged last week that indicated chemical weapons have been used in the conflict in Syria. Western nations claiming that it was the Syrian government who used the weapons have threatened a military strike. The conflict in Syria has raged since the initial uprising in 2011. Unlike the uprising in other Arab nations, the Syrian regime has not been toppled. And despite thousands killed and displaced, there still appears to be considerable support for the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today, as the world's attention is focused on Syria, we take a look at the man at the heart of the regime, Bashar al-Assad. According to Nihar Siris, Syrian writer and author, you can't understand President Assad without looking at his father.
First of all, we can't understand Bashar al-Assad as a person, as a president, if we don't remember his father. Hafez al-Assad, he came from the military, and after he took power in Syria, in 1970, we could say dictatorship because all power was in one hand.
Hafez al-Assad was the son of a peasant from the Syrian mountains. He was a very ambitious young man and saw an opportunity to better himself through the army and slowly made his way up through the ranks. He knocked out his opponents that had once been his collaborators, and in 1970 took control of the country.
Stephen Starr is a journalist. He lived in Syria for 5 years and is the author of The Revolt in Syria, Eyewitness to an Uprising.
There's a very important thing to remember, I think. Hafez al-Assad built the regime from the ground up. Bashar al-Assad has simply inherited this regime that his father built. Bashar al-Assad doesn't understand Syria like his father did.
We certainly know that he had a much more forceful older brother. Basil al-Assad had a career in the armed forces. He was a sportsman. He was a renowned horse rider. He was an energetic, charismatic fellow. And his father had pretty much looked to Basil al-Assad to be the successor.
Fred Lawson is Professor of International Relations and Middle East Politics at Mills College in the United States.
President Bashar also has an older sister, and the older sister is a forceful personality in her own right. So between the two of them, I'm sure that the current president was a little bit out of the limelight and went into a professional career, went into the career of medicine, which means that he must have had very good marks, probably had good connections as well, but certainly he was a competent physician, competent enough to do postgraduate training in the United Kingdom.
We get the sense that Bashar al-Assad never wanted a political role or to be involved in politics, but when his brother died, he was essentially the next in line and had little choice in that decision. He studied in the UK in London for a short time. We do know that. And there's often a sense, I think, that people feel that because he lived and studied in the UK, in a Western country, that he would pick up a sensibility about how to govern or about how to view people. And certainly he wouldn't be the kind of guy who's involved in statewide repression that has killed over 100,000 people. But I think the truth of the matter is that when he lived in the UK, when he lived in London, he wasn't exposed to Western values. He was surrounded by a group of Arab men. He rarely interacted with locals. There was very little sense that he came to pick up the values of what we kind of perceive to be important in terms of governance and free speech and that. So I think the idea that Bashar al-Assad was somehow influenced by living in London, I think this is perhaps a false one.
He was in England when his brother died in an accident. he received a call from the presidential palace to return back to Syria at once.
President Bashar was only 28 years old when this happened and was called back immediately from Britain, was parachuted into the military academy, rose through the ranks, graduated with the rank of colonel, and pretty much overnight was put in the place of his older brother. The president then assigned Bashar al-Assad to be head of the anti-corruption campaign as a way to give some political clout and some political reputation to Bashar al-Assad. He was also put in charge of the Syrian Computer Society. And most people say that this is a way to show that Bashar al-Assad is a man of the modern world. He's someone who's cosmopolitan, someone who knows how to work in a technical environment. He was publicized as someone who could bring Syria into the modern world.
They started to prepare him for the presidency because his father was suffering from several diseases and everyone knows that he will die soon. So preparing for this job, they start to spread a word that Bashar, he will be a reformer. If he took the job, he will change life of Syrians to be better. And everyone knows that Bashar, he wanted to spread technology, computers and satellite channels, which at that time it wasn't permitted to have satellite channel instrument in your house. So Syrians started to think that maybe this time Bashar will come and change their life to be better.
As the coffin arrived in the city's main square, the chanting stopped, and for many, hysteria driven by the heat.
Tens of thousands of Syrians have taken to the nation's streets in grief following the death of the man who ruled the country for a generation. At the same time, the late president's political machine is pushing through measures to ensure the hasty succession of his son Bashar to power.
His father then did die when Bashar al-Assad was 34 years old. The problem was that the Constitution specified that presidents have to be 40 years old. So the afternoon after the death of Hafez al-Assad was announced, the People's Assembly, the legislature, met in special session and changed the Constitution so that now presidents could be 34 years old. And at that point, President Bashar al-Assad was made head of the Ba'ath Party, commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and a little later then was elected president as well.
And when he came to power as president, did he bring new people in with him, or did he very much just adopt the kind of power structures that his father had set up?
There are two important ways to answer that question. One way is that for about the preceding year, 18 months, before Hafez al-Assad died, there were major shakeups in the Council of Ministers and even in the Politburo of the Ba'ath Party. And most observers said that the way was being prepared for Bashar al-Assad, because old-line, long-time leaders were being retired and replaced with fresh faces, usually younger, usually people who did not have much experience. People said these were allies of Bashar al-Assad being put in place by his father, or while his father was still around. By the same token, though, a large group of these barons, a large group of old party figures, are still in place.
You're with Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today, as the eyes of the world are on Syria, we take a look at the man at the centre of the storm, President Bashar al-Assad. In his first speech after being elected president in 2000, President Assad raised expectations that political reform in Syria was possible.
Bashar al-Assad, in his inaugural address, makes reference to opening the country up, opening the economy, allowing some freedom of expression, allowing people to have a little more role in policymaking. So very quickly after the current president's inaugural address, small groups of liberal reformers and civil rights activists started meeting in weekly soirees and holding discussion groups and having lectures. And some of these lecture groups even had political content to them. And for about 6 months, maybe 8 months, the authorities stood back, the security services let these soirees go on, and observers started talking about a Damascus spring.
I remember that in the first year, the government opened doors for dialogue in media and in newspapers, and we called it Damascus Spring because it was movement and the still water started to move and people start to be optimistic. But this stay for maybe less than 1 year when everything stopped.
By the end of the winter of his first year as president, suddenly the Damascus Spring got shut down. Suddenly the security services started to demand seeing an agenda for meetings. Suddenly the security services started taking names. And by the late spring, many of the civil rights activists had been rounded up and put in prison. We still don't exactly know how the Damascus Spring got shut down. Some people say that maybe even Bashar al-Assad thought that things were going out of control and going too far. But other people say that maybe the president was a reformer, but his arm got twisted or he got persuaded by the shadowy barons to clamp things down.
I never believed that because this is something you hear in almost any authoritarian or dictatorial system that, well, the leader is good and he wants the best and he wants to be a democrat and he wants to respect human rights, but it's all these ugly people around him who are doing all the mistakes or are preventing a real opening up.
Volker Perthes is the director of the German Institute for International Security Affairs in Berlin.
Now, you could ask if he has all these people around him who are doing that, why doesn't he replace them if he has so much power? And there are enough instances over the 13 years now that he has been in power where he actually has proven that he is in control. Whenever he wanted to have a decision, he did get it. That relates both to policy issues as well as to personnel issues. It's true that it took a couple of years for him to organize his own power base, but after 5 years, he had done so, and he had done so very systematically, starting by exchanging governors, deputies in the parliament, ministers, and at the very end, after 5 years or so, he was able to replace some of the top guys who had actually helped him to get into his presidential position after the death of his father.
While the new president allowed the Damascus Spring to be closed down, he remained committed to the opening up of the Syrian economy.
Things opened up pretty dramatically economically. The new president gave freer rein to economic liberalizers. And so pockets of liberalization and pockets of connection to the outside world grew up pretty dramatically.
You saw an explosion of new restaurants, private banks, new cars on the streets of the major cities. You saw the young urban dwellers become quite wealthy, and their lives certainly improved greatly. At the same time, you had the almost complete destruction of the rural class, in that when subsidies were dropped as part of this neoliberal approach to the economy, they weren't able to buy diesel to fuel their irrigation system, so their crops failed. There was also an unfortunate drought for about 3 years from 2008 to 2011, which drove up to 1 million Syrians off the land and into the kind of poor urban areas around Damascus and around Aleppo. Now, those areas, you probably know them by name. Those areas are Douma and Madamiye and Eastern Ghouta, and these are all places where today have been in the last couple of years, have been the heart and soul of the actual revolution itself. So you had a massive movement of people from the countryside into the poorer urban areas, where they drove taxis at night time, where they had no education to speak of. They couldn't get jobs. They were in a very, very difficult economic position. And when protests began in Deraa on March 15th, the match struck and the fire caught on in these poor kind of urban areas.
It all began with the death of a simple street seller in Tunisia. A year ago today, Mohamed Bouazizi had his vegetable cart confiscated by local officials. In protest, he set himself on fire and in doing so ignited not just himself, but a string of anti-government demonstrations that have transformed the Arab world.
In January and February 2011, the entire country was glued to Al Jazeera. People were watching what was happening in Egypt and what was happening in Tunisia, what was happening in Yemen and what was happening in Libya. You know, people were in great admiration for the Tunisian people and the Egyptian people. But no Syrians felt that this was something that could be repeated in Syria. There was a sense that the regime would have to make some changes, that there was going to be some pressure on it. But there was no sense whatsoever that people would start calling for the fall of the regime.
It actually looked like that, not only because Bashar al-Assad thought and actually said in an interview with an American newspaper that what happened in Egypt and Tunisia couldn't happen to Syria, because, as he said, he was in much closer contact with the people, he was much more popular. Of course, there was the generational aspect that he is much younger than Mubarak and Zain al-Abidin al-Ali, sort of closer to the revolutionary generation. And I would agree to the extent that he could have weathered the storm had he been prepared from the first weeks and months in 2011 to undertake some significant political reform steps, which he didn't, or which he didn't at that time. Some of the things have been suggested later, even by himself or some of his aides. But in 2011, that would have been the time to say, we see where the winds are blowing in the Arab world. We want to be ahead of the storm rather than being taken by the storm, and we will go for fresh and free parliamentary elections. We will allow parties to really compete. We will do away with the monopoly of the Ba'ath Party, and much, much more important, we will seriously fight corruption and we will seriously rein in the security services. He didn't decide to do that, or he probably even decided consciously not to do it, not to open up.
In the first protests, to give you a timeline, a number of young children wrote some graffiti on a school wall that says Shabi Urid Yusqat al-Nizam, which means the people want to follow the regime, which is simply something they had seen on TV from Tunisia or Egypt. And they were taken to a security center by secret police / security center by the school principal. They were kept there. Apparently their fingernails were pulled out and they were tortured. Their parents went looking for them, and they too were also detained. The following Friday, there was a small protest. In the case of a couple of these young kids, they were from quite prominent families, and they were able to get some kind of grassroots support in Deraa. And by the 15th of March, there was a large protest that the government decided to fire on in Deraa, and it sparked from there.
When people start to watch and to read about the violence and killing which the security apparatus and the army behave against the people, they start to demonstrate against violence. No one thought about a revolution or to topple the regime. And media keeps telling lies about some gangs. Everyone knows that the people who demonstrate, they are good people, nice, and they are students. They like not to be tortured, not to be to put in situation as not human.
To Syria now, where President Bashar al-Assad has announced that in 10 days' time, a referendum will be held on a new constitution for his country.
The Syrian president's latest offer of political reform coincides with yet another military crackdown, not only in Homs, but now also in the city of Hama and a suburb of Damascus.
It's hard for me to think what might have been going through the president's own head, but he was certainly overtaken by the hardliners. He was overtaken by military commanders who resorted to force at the very first sign of trouble. My initial thought when the shooting broke out down in the south around Deraa was that perhaps local commanders took initiatives that were not authorized from the capital.
The question to ask is who Who made the decision to fire on protesters in Deraa on March 15th? I don't think Bashar said, shoot the protesters. I don't believe he made that call. Now, I can guess that it was his brother, and certainly the 4th Division was sent to Deraa to quell the uprising in the early days. I don't doubt for a second that Bashar is 100% on board today, but it's unlikely that he did actually say, shoot these protesters, and not let's talk to them or use tear gas or let's find another way to work this out. His brother is a very shady character indeed. We know very little about him other than he has a questionable temper. He's quite a violent individual, we're led to believe. And that part of his whole mystique is that no one really knows much about him, and that there's a mysterious kind of element to him and to what he does. And obviously, people are quite fearful of him.
I guess inside the regime, and of course the regime basis has narrowed a lot in the last 2.5 years, inside the regime he is fully in charge, and he is probably more in charge than before. There is his brother, there are the people in the security services who are his enforcers, but they don't act on their own. There have been discussions, as we know, in the party leadership where people like his vice president, Farouk Sharra, and others have recommended to react politically to the protests rather than militarily. But it was him, the president, who said, no, we're going to have a military or a security solution, as he called it, which meant a military solution. And then when we put the revolt down, then we can start to speak about political changes, not before.
If you look at the way the uprisings sort of played out in other parts of the Arab world, you often saw the military changing sides, not wanting to fire on the people. But the way it's played out in Syria has been very different. And I'm wondering why that is and how the president has been able to hold the regime together over the past 2 years.
Well, there are two factors here which are important to explain this phenomenon, which you rightly mentioned. The Syrian army is much, much less a professional army than the Tunisian army or the Egyptian army. It is a heavily politicized army. It is an army which has been committed to serving the goals of the Ba'ath party, of the ruling party, and that means the president. Then the other is that we have this ethnic or sectarian divisions in Syria where Bashar al-Assad and his closest aides belong to the sectarian minority of the Alawites, and they have made sure that Alawite officers are controlling at least the important units of the army very closely. You might have a Sunni or a Christian commander of a unit, but then you would always have an Alawi as a deputy who actually controls promotions, controls which officer is at which decisive position. The result was that even though a couple of brigadiers and generals and colonels have defected, the crack units of the army have remained stable and under regime control. They have been built up in the past as units to shield the regime or protect the regime, rather than units to protect the country.
But in a way, does that explain how the regime has been able to maintain its position? Clearly, there must be still quite a few people within Syria that still support him.
Yes, this is the case. Syrian society is divided. We don't know exact figures, of course, because you never had opinion polls in Syria, and under the current circumstances, it wouldn't be possible to have opinion polls, but you can guesstimate and say, well, you have 25% of the people who are really committed to the opposition and to overthrowing the regime, and you may have 20% or perhaps a little bit more, a little bit less, who are still supporting the regime, and that includes a large part of the Alawite community and merchants and people in the bureaucracy who have made careers under the system, regardless of what their confessional belong is. It includes a part of the Christian and other minorities who find it more reassuring that someone from a minority rules the country then the Sunni majority or representatives of the Sunni majority ruling the country, where they fear Islamists taking over and encroaching on the freedoms of minority. So you have sort of on both sides probably up to a quarter of the people who have a very clear position and support the one or the other side. And I guess in the middle you have 30, 40, perhaps 50% of the people who simply want it to be over.
The United Nations Security Council has called for a prompt investigation into an alleged chemical weapon attack yesterday outside the Syrian capital Damascus, which is believed to have killed hundreds of people.
For him, it is about to win or to lose. And when a situation gets militarily worse, as it apparently did in the suburbs of Damascus the days before this attack, then he would be prepared to use all kind of means in order to win or to not suffer a military defeat.
I think every time he faces a new condition or something, he must think how to act. He thinks about his father, what his father would do in these circumstances. He remembers in 1982 when the Muslim Brotherhood went to fight the regime in Aleppo and other cities. Then the father acted very harshly, and also he sent tanks and mortars to shell Hama. One third of it was destroyed.
Look, he certainly started to be the product of the education in his father's house. But since he took power, 12 years, almost 13 years have gone. And that's a longer period than usually a prime minister in Australia or a president in the United States or a chancellor in Germany is in office. So he has certainly learned something. Has he learned the right things? I would say no, but he has learned to survive. And he has survived more than one crisis. Remember that when he had to withdraw his forces, Syrian forces, from Lebanon after the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, a lot of people thought, well, this is the political end of Bashar al-Assad. He was able to sit that out. So he has learned to survive. He has learned to rely on a small elite of trusted allies and friends. He has learned that he doesn't need the entire country. For the time being, for his survival, he is probably happy, or at least he is content, with ruling over 25-30% of the country and its population.
Volker Pardes, Director of the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin. My other guests, Nihad Siris, Syrian writer and author. Fred Lawson, Professor of International Relations and Middle East Politics at Mills College. And journalist Stephen Starr, author of The Revolt in Syria, Eyewitness to the Uprising. The current feature on the Rear Vision website is a program tracing the history and development of chemical weapons, and well worth a listen. Just head for the Rear Vision website. Today's sound engineer is Andrei Shabanov. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN. Thanks for joining us.